the recording for this. And let me check the slide. I put a slide up for you, Beth, that has your picture. Uh-huh. And it has the picture of your book and the link for you, for your book, and then also the Epidemic Answers logo with our website there, and then the Indiegogo.
Great. Perfect.
Website there, too. Okay. All right. So we're going to go ahead and get started with today's webinar. Thank you for joining us. I'm Maria Rickert Hong. I'm a health coach, and I trained at the Institute for Integrative Nutrition. I'm also a board member of Epidemic Answers. And today we've got Beth Lambert with us, and she's the executive director and co-founder of Epidemic Answers. And Beth will be telling you about Epidemic Answers in just a little bit. But just to let you know a little bit about her, she's a former healthcare consultant and a teacher. And as a consultant, she worked with pharmaceutical, medical device, diagnostic, and other healthcare companies to evaluate industry trends. She is the author of A Compromised Generation, The Epidemic of Chronic Illness in America's Children. In 2009, Beth founded Epidemic Answers and currently serves as executive director. Beth attended Oxford University and graduated from Williams College and holds a master's degree in American Studies from Fairfield University. She is a member of Alpha Sigma Nu, the Jesuit Honor Society. And Beth is also the mother of three young children. So welcome, Beth. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Maria.
All right. So let's go ahead and get started. What we'll do is I'll ask you some questions. And then at the end of this, we'll have time for Q&A. And so for those of you who've dialed in by phone, at the end of this, you can press star 2 to raise your hand, and we'll get to you then. Or if you've connected with a computer, then you can just type into the chat box, and you can ask the questions there. So here's the first question for you, Beth. For those who don't know about it, can you tell us about your book, A Compromised Generation?
Sure. Just to give some context for where this book came out of, I was a relatively new mom. And I was pursuing my master's degree at the time, and my oldest daughter was developing all kinds of bizarre health symptoms, and it was the kind of thing that eluded a diagnosis, and we went to a variety of different physicians, gastroenterologists and allergists and you name it. We went to go see them trying to figure out what was going on with her. She had a sensory issues and bowel issues and skin issues and behavioral issues. And she almost, you know, had all these symptoms that looked like she might be sort of leading towards autism, but she clearly wasn't autistic, never would have gotten a diagnosis like that, but had something going on. And through the journey of finding out what was going on with her, I also became aware and educated to the fact that millions of children were manifesting symptoms like my daughter. And not only that, but that they were part of a bigger epidemic of chronic illness affecting really the industrialized world, but certainly people in the United States more often. And what I'm talking about is, you know, these skyrocketing rates of autism and ADHD and asthma and food allergies and celiac disease and pediatric depression and things that, you know, we didn't really talk about just a few decades ago, but now is sort of in our mainstream dialogue. I mean, this is what parents talk about at playgroups now. So as I was going through this experience with my daughter and healing her and recovering her, and this is sort of part of the journey, was learning that, oh my gosh, kids who have these symptoms or these diagnoses, whether it be ADHD, autism, or asthma, these kids can recover, and this is phenomenal, and this is incredible, but this is not something you hear in your pediatrician's office. So, you know, I did the research to find out what was going on. Why were all these kids sick? And I delved into the medical literature, and I spoke with, you know, dozens and dozens of medical experts and researchers to try and figure out why could we be having all these children sick today? What could be contributing to it? Because you certainly don't have genetic epidemics. There's something in the environment, something that's changed in the last you know, 100 plus years, but more so in the last few decades, something has changed to make our children sick. And so that was the origin of my book. And it, you know, it started out as a thesis, and it mushroomed into a book. And I found a lot of people supportive of the environmental etiology concept, and the fact that all of these things that were happening to our kids had to do with the environment. So what my book really talks about is, first of all, I document that there is an epidemic. I mean, people say, well, we're just better at diagnosing kids with autism. And yes, that's true, but that doesn't attribute for the ridiculous numbers of children that we have affected today. And yes, we are perhaps over-diagnosing ADHD, but it still is only a fraction of, that only accounts for a fraction of the increase in number of children that are affected. We are, without a doubt, experiencing epidemics in things that are not subjective in terms of how you diagnose them. So, for instance, anaphylactic allergies. There's no question that those are just ballooning out of control. Asthma is not something that's subjectively diagnosed, and that's ballooning out of control. So the first portion of my book, A Compromised Generation, documents that, yes, in fact, this is an epidemic. It's a crisis. It's a major health crisis that's affecting our nation. And, you know, these children are going to grow up to be adults, and we are going to be saddled with the burden of healthcare costs. If that's, you know, all that moves you, let alone the, you know, the emotional and social challenges that are presented by this epidemic. So that's the first piece of my book. And the second piece of my book is looking at why. I mean, my training really actually is more of a historian. I wanted to analyze this problem from a historical perspective. You know, if you look 100 years ago, there really weren't any allergies. I mean, you had hay fever, which begins in the 19th century. And then, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, you begin to have a little bit of anaphylaxis, but you don't get the, you know, the 4 million anaphylactic peanut allergies that we have today. And so historically, what changed? And that's what the crux of the book is looking at the perfect storm of environmental factors that are contributing to all of these conditions skyrocketing in children. And then the way I put it is that if you look at any of them, if you look at a child with autism or if you look at a child with allergies or ADHD, you take any of them and you do a biomedical type workup on them. In other words, you take labs on blood and look at to see how their gastrointestinal system is functioning. You look to see what their immune factors look like. How is their immune system functioning? If you do this kind of workup with these children, you'll find universally across the board, almost all of them have dysfunction in their gastrointestinal system, and almost all of them have dysfunction in their immune system. Now, they may have other things going on. There may be disruptions to their endocrine system. They may have heavy metal toxicities. I mean, there's a whole variety of things going on in our children, especially those with autism spectrum disorders. But any of these kids, even kids with learning disabilities, you can find these kind of biological imbalances in them. So to me, I wanted to know what was causing these imbalances in kids. Why did all these kids have problems with their guts, and why did they have problems with their immune systems? And so I started digging around in the medical literature, and what I found was that really there is no one simple answer in this soundbite society that's really hard for people to swallow. But there are answers, and it's sort of a confluence of things that's contributing to this epidemic of what I call immune dysregulation and gut dysbiosis. Gut dysbiosis is when you have an imbalance in the good germs versus the bad germs in your gut. And so if you look through history to see what might be causing gut dysbiosis, what might be causing immune dysregulation, you start finding all of these breadcrumbs. You find the breadcrumb trail. You find all the evidence. And I put it into five categories, the five categories of environmental factors that are contributing to our kids being sick. The first category, which I think is very significant, is the overuse of pharmaceutical compounds. And I used to work in the pharmaceutical industry, and while there are many, many wonderful people that work in that industry, it's still a business, and it's a business that is thrives on pushing medications, whether you need them or not. I mean, it's just a fact. And our country is the highest consumer of pharmaceutical agents in the world. And so one of those agents that's particularly damaging is antibiotics that we've been using since the Second World War, and increasingly so in the last two decades. And that's an example of one of the types of things that can contribute to gut dysbiosis. gut dysbiosis can also contribute to immune dysregulation, which is apparent in kids who have autism or apparent in kids who have ADHD. Most people don't understand that autism, for instance, is it's very much an autoimmune disorder. There are autoimmune components to autism as well as toxicities and other things going on. But these immune systems are dysregulated. So there's other things that affect the immune system besides the gut health. For instance, excessive or improperly administered immunizations can cause an immune system to be dysregulated. It's documented in the medical literature that vaccines cause autoimmunity in some people. So that's another kind of component. Do all children who have autism, have they been vaccinated? Not all of them. So it's not a singular factor. But what I say in the book and what I try to explain to people is that, you know, overuse of medications, excessive vaccination, the standard American diet, nutrition is another one of those five factors I mentioned. These things are all working in concert to compromise the health of our children. The other things that I mention are sort of lifestyle factors, for instance. You know, we're not getting enough vitamin D from outdoor exposure. How we deliver babies in this country is actually a factor, and it's quite complex. But again, there's sort of a synergy of environmental factors that are creating this epidemic of health. I could go on and on, Maria. I know this is sort of it's a hard concept to synthesize in a short amount of time. But, you know, I will summarize the main thrust of the book. The main concept is that, yes, we have an epidemic. It is caused by things that have changed in our environment over the last few decades. And the most important piece of my book is that kids recover. If you address the environmental factors, if you clean up these kids' environments and help regulate their guts, feed them nutritiously, and get them their bodies back in balance, they can recover. Kids can recover, and I think that's the most important part of my book, is that message of hope.
Right. Absolutely. So when you say the perfect storm, you're talking about antibiotics, pharmaceuticals, lifestyle, nutrition, or the diet that we have, stress that we have, and then toxicities as well. Is there anything that I'm leaving out there, or?
No, I mean, those are sort of the five main categories. But within each of them, there's sort of complex factors. I mean, for instance, nutrition, I just sort of breezed over that, but that's a huge factor. I mean, there's so many, especially children in this country, who really eat diets that are high in simple sugars and carbohydrates, are highly processed. And plus, we're eating a ton of toxins and chemicals in our diet, you know, chemicals on the produce we eat, or genetically modified organisms, which are linked to all kinds of immune system abnormalities, and they can cause or have been linked with allergies and dysfunctions of the immune system. So the pesticides and the additives and the preservatives that we're taking in through our diet, the fact that we're not eating foods that promote gut health. So, for instance, I mean, one of the things I spend so much time talking about in my book is the importance of gut health. Again, 70% of your immune system is located in your gut. So if you're not taking care of your gut through a proper diet, your immune system is going to suffer. There are consequences, and it can cause overgrowth of the wrong kinds of microbes in your gut. And that can affect everything from, you know, how you digest your food, of course, and take in your nutrients from the food, or whether you take in nutrients from food. But believe it or not, it can affect things as important as the production of neurotransmitters. For instance, the vast majority of serotonin, that important brain chemical, is manufactured in the gut. And so if you're not eating the right kinds of foods that make the right kinds of bacteria grow in your gut, then you may be compromising everything, really, with regard to your health. So, you know, those five topics I mentioned, the diet, nutrition, there's a lot to them. There's a lot of things going on. The toxins, this one I sort of breezed over too. We are in such a toxic environment, and it's kind of one of those things that people are almost tired of hearing about. Yes, I know about pollution. Yes, I know it's dangerous. I know there's toxic things out there. But really, I don't think people have any idea how it's affecting our health. And so, for instance, mercury, it's everywhere in the environment, and certainly people have heard about the toxicity of eating seafood and fish, because especially the larger fish that tend to aggregate mercury. But people aren't really understanding that we're taking those metals into our own body and storing them. And the gut flora, which I talk about again and again, the germs in your gut actually play a really important role in this. And so people who have compromised gut flora, they don't have the right kind of germs in their gut, they actually can't eliminate the toxins that they're exposed to as effectively. And the best example I can give from this, I love this study, I talk about it all the time. There was a man in the 80s who took two groups of mice, and he fed them different mouse diets. One was kind of a high-fiber mouse diet, and one was kind of a, you know, junk food mouse diet. And the mice that ate the high-fiber diet, they were then both fed mercury, and the mice that received the high-fiber diet helped to excrete the mercury out of their body. In other words, the high-fiber diet was what helped those good germs in the gut thrive, and those good germs in the gut actually help demethylate mercury or make it less toxic to our body and help us eliminate it. That same study was done where they took two groups of mice, fed them the same diet, and then they gave one group of mice antibiotics, and that wiped out all the good bacteria in the gut, and the other group of mice did not receive the antibiotics. And then they fed both groups of mice mercury. And again, what you saw was that the group of mice that had received the antibiotics, they actually retained the mercury in their fatty tissues, in their liver, in their brain, and so they weren't able to excrete the mercury as effectively, whereas the mice that did not receive the antibiotics were able to excrete the mercury in their stool. So what that tells you is the antibiotics, which kill the good bacteria, are, you know, crippling us in terms of our ability to detoxify those kinds of toxins that come into our environment. So, you know, I sort of breeze over the fact that toxins are something that is contributing to this epidemic of illness in children, but it's really quite serious. And we're talking about potent things like mercury and aluminum, which are neurotoxic, antimony, BPA, industrial chemicals, pesticides. There's so many things that we're exposed to that are toxic to our brains and our bodies, but we're not as effective at detoxifying them as we might have been, say, 50 years ago, before we had several generations of people who've received dozens upon dozens of antibiotics and other kinds of medications. It's not just antibiotics, but, you know, for instance, proton pump inhibitors like Prilosec or Prevacid, those actually help to destroy our gut flora as well. So when I talk about the perfect storm, I'm really talking about sort of lots of different exposures or things that contribute to our inability to detoxify and our inability to keep our bodies in balance. So
can you? Yeah, that was a mouthful.
Yeah, I know.
That's great.
I could go on for hours.
I know. when you were talking about generations of toxins and antibiotics, can you talk about the mother's role in passing on, unfortunately, these kinds of things to the children and how that actually happens?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. So there's two things going on in terms of parents. There's a hereditary piece, and I'm not talking specifically about genetics and genetic mutations, although that certainly plays, you know, a small role. I'm talking about epigenetics and how we there's a hereditary component. So if for instance, a mother were exposed to toxins, those toxins can, you know, upregulate or downregulate certain genes, which are then passed on to their children. But even more important than that, I think, is the toxicities and the inherent imbalances that the mother in particular carries in her body prior to conception, pregnancy, and then what she carries forth for her child. If she has gut dysbiosis, which again is that imbalance between good bacteria and bad bacteria, if she has some kind of opportunistic organisms in her gastrointestinal tract that have, you know, set up massive colonies, the most common, of course, is Candida. There are others, though. And what happens when a baby is born is that the baby is basically, their gut is virtually sterile when they come out of the womb. And if they're born vaginally, the natural rhythm of life is that the baby's gut is inoculated with the vaginal and gut flora from the mother. And that's just the way it works, and it's actually a really great system because that's how the baby sort of learns about their environment. And oral tolerance is kind of set up that way. There's a learning that is shared from the gut bacteria in the mother to the gut bacteria in the baby. It's a beautiful system, but the problem is when it's out of whack in the mother, it gets transferred to the baby. So if the mother has gut dysbiosis, the baby most likely will end up having gut dysbiosis anyway. Toxicity is another piece of this too. Mothers carry very heavy toxic burdens these days. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of and know about the environmental working groups look at study of umbilical cord blood and how there's so hundreds of toxins, things that are, you know, can cause cancer, that are neurotoxic, that are transferred from the mother to the baby in utero. And so mothers who, you know, had diets that are, you know, so heavy in sushi, let's say, and they got a lot of mercury through that way, they're going to transfer those metals onto their baby, and that's going to have a neurotoxic effect on their baby, and especially at a critical time when they're growing and developing. But a really interesting thing, if you're talking about transferring, you know, from mother to baby, is that one thing that we do in this country in particular, and this is true for the Western world, but very much so a part of American culture, is how we birth babies in this country. And this actually really has an impact on the health and wellness of babies. So in this country, we have about a third of babies are delivered by a C-section. And why that's significant is because if your baby is born via C-section, they're not getting inoculated with the mother's gut flora and vaginal flora the way that happens in a vaginal birth. And the baby is, you know, susceptible more to colonizing their gut with whatever bacteria, et cetera, happens to be in the hospital. But more importantly, the mother receives antibiotics intravenously, typically, with a C-section. So right at the time when that critical bacteria is needed to colonize the baby's gut through breastfeeding, for instance. There's bacteria that are transferred through breastfeeding. Bifidus bacteria is a probiotic that's transferred through breastfeeding. The mother is receiving antibiotics and killing all of her good bacteria. So that presents an opportunity for opportunistic or pathogenic bacteria to colonize the baby's gut. And the other piece of it is we do, in terms of birthing habits and patterns in this country, we have a protocol in most hospitals in this country where we look for something called group beta strep, which is a potentially deadly bacteria, although it lives in us all the time, sort of in an innocuous way. But it's been associated with meningitis and sepsis and in a very rare case. So what they do is they do a vaginal swab of mothers at about 37 weeks or so to look for group beta strep. If they find it, it's protocol to put the mother on intravenous antibiotics during labor in the hospital. So now women in this country, you have about 40% of women in this country will test positive for group beta strep with a vaginal swab at any given time. So that's a near majority of women going in for delivery in a hospital, they're likely to test positive for group B strep. It comes and goes in our bodies. You may or may not have it. So we don't know exactly how many women are testing positive at delivery time, but we know it's a significant number of women. And that means that combined with cesarean sections, group beta strep protocol, you have a ton of women in this country who are receiving intravenous antibiotics right as that baby is being born, right at that critical time when they need that mother's good gut flora to be transferred. And so what we're doing is we're then presenting a situation where the baby's gut flora is compromised. That means their immune system is compromised. And if you take that all into consideration, then the other thing we do right then is we immunize them with hepatitis B vaccines when their immune systems are not necessarily operating at 100%. So it's a complex kind of phenomenon going on, but what you're seeing culturally is that there are lots of opportunities for the mother and her imbalances and her toxicities to be transferred onto the baby. So the babies are born without really much of a chance. I mean, they're really being born at a disadvantage. So we have to be very careful about how we bring babies into this world, especially with regard to that gut flora and protecting that gut flora in the early days. So I know that was a long answer to your question, but you're absolutely right. I mean, I think pregnant mothers and even preconception is better, but people need to be thinking about cleaning up their bodies and maybe assessing their toxicities. And you would probably know, Maria, a lot of the ways that women can do that. What's that?
Yeah, and I said, yeah, I've gone through this, and I actually had the
the antibiotics administered, unfortunately, during delivery both times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about this. And I
but you're
I
not
was,
the only one. And that's the thing. It's
yeah.
not your fault. It's protocol. It's the kind of
yeah.
thing that most people, most women going into the hospital, they just follow what our doctor's orders, and it's protocol. So, you know, why would you ever question protocol? The thing is I don't think most medical professionals have any idea what these antibiotics at birth are doing. They just don't.
Right.
So we're, you know, it's like anything else in modern medicine. It usually takes, you know, 10, 20 years for the medical, you know, literature to catch up, and then it has to trickle down through the practitioners. So, it's a complex phenomenon, but that's why we're out talking about it.
We are. All right. And a lot of this is, I know when I was first going through this myself, it's very, very overwhelming. So what would you recommend that other parents do? And you talked about recovery also. So what can we do to recover our kids?
I think the most important thing parents can do is to start being vigilant and paying attention to their children's symptoms. So an example is you go into your pediatrician's office and you say, oh, my child is constipated. And your pediatrician, I mean, and they say this for good reason, but they might say, you know, well, that's common. Most kids will be constipated at one time or another. Or, you know, most kids will be have chronic diarrhea for, you know, a couple weeks. It's no big deal. It'll resolve itself. But a parent, if their gut is telling them something isn't right with their child, they need to investigate it and move beyond the pediatrician, because a pediatrician is an extremely taxed person in our culture. They're very, very busy. They don't have the time to spend to assess every single person. And they're dealing also with parents who are, you know, there's a lot of helicopter parents out there who are sort of over worried or over concerned. So a lot of times they tend to dismiss our concerns. So what I would say mm-hmm. to people is don't let your concerns be dismissed, and find a healthcare practitioner who will listen to your concerns. So if there's a chronic symptom that your child has, seek out a practitioner who will take you seriously. Now, on the Epidemic Answers website, we have a practitioner database that we're trying to build. We've just sort of launched it, and we're populating it. But it is a database of practitioners who are trained and experienced in recovering kids from these kinds of conditions. And so that would be the most important piece, is finding a practitioner who will listen to you and help you get to the root of your child's symptoms. And I think it's heartening to know that there's lots of practitioners out there. Most of them tend to be in sort of the holistic universe, integrative, environmental medicine. These are kind of functional medicine. These are, you know, keywords or terms to look for when you're looking for somebody who's going to assist you. But recovering a child, the first step is finding somebody who knows how to do it in terms of a healthcare practitioner. And then the second piece to it, I think, is starting to be mindful and pay attention to the things that are in your child's environment. Does your child have a lot of personal care products and toys that might be toxic? And there's resources for assessing these things in our home. So you kind of want to evaluate your home and make sure that it's clean and green. The Environmental Working Group is a great database for that, EWG.org, or a great resource, I should say. You just start looking for the most natural products you can to try and reduce the toxic burden on our children's bodies. And the other thing I would say is nutrition is extraordinarily important. We don't really pay attention to nutrition in this country. We sort of follow, if anything, we follow the food pyramid, which is not really nutrition. It's more of an industry lobby designed food guide. But, you know, working with a nutritionist or somebody who is trained in, like yourself, Maria, is trained in understanding how nutrition correlates directly to health and wellness, and even just educating yourself. There's lots of organizations out there that you can learn about nutrition from. So I think those are key pieces for a parent who's looking to address a chronic illness with a child. It's find a practitioner, clean up your home and your environment, and it is focus on nutrition. Nutrition is hugely important. I know you know that, Maria.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You had mentioned about a child who has either constipation or diarrhea when you take them to the doctor. What are some of the other soft signs that you see with kids that are in this epidemic right now?
That's a really good question. There's so many. I mean, Epidemic Answers, as you know, Maria, puts out a piece of literature that literally has a laundry list of different symptoms that kids exhibit that are sort of, again, the soft signs or the red flags that they might be affected by this epidemic, that they might be showing gut dysbiosis or immune dysregulation. But some of the examples would be, you know, a baby who has reflux and is vomiting after they have their mother's breast milk, that baby is experiencing some kind of immune problem. They're probably reacting to foods that the mother's eating. And that's immune dysregulation. That's food sensitivities. That's new, by the way. Babies have not been spitting up their mother's breast milk for thousands of years. This is new. Other kinds of red flags would be sensory issues, kids who can't tolerate being touched, or kids who don't like the feelings of grass or sand, or, I mean, and I'm not just talking about like a little sensitivity. I'm talking about kids who are, you know, cover their ears because things are too loud, or can't stand bright lights. Those are sensory disorders. Kids who don't feel like they're comfortable in their bodies, or they crash into things, or continuously clumsy. Those are kinds of red flags. Kids who have low muscle tone, who don't quite, you know, they tend to be sort of like a floppy child. Kids who have distended bellies, or like you said before, the chronic diarrhea or chronic constipation, those are all red flags. If a kid has undigested food in their stool or blood in their stool, again, red flags. One of the most ubiquitous soft signs I see, I mean, it is just everywhere. If you go into a preschool or a daycare center, you see the ubiquitous red cheeks. And to me, what that's telling you is that child is allergic to something in their environment. And not necessarily, you know, you go into an allergist and you get a skin prick test. It doesn't have to be a diagnosed allergy. It can be a sensitivity. And that's actually most commonly what it is, a food sensitivity, which are really hard to diagnose. One easy way to diagnose it is if your child eats lunch and then they get red cheeks or red ears after lunch, something they're eating is causing them to have an inflammatory immune response. That means their immune system is dysregulated. And so you have to sort of catalog, all right, well, what did they just eat? And then you do a food journal to see what they're eating and what might be causing that. Food sensitivities are ubiquitous in this day and age, meaning most people don't know they have these sensitivities, but they're in a chronic state of inflammation. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing you're looking for your kid, is any kind of skin condition, any kind of sign or symptom that they're reacting to something. Sometimes it's behavior. One of my daughters would eat food and then immediately temper tantrum. There was no, you know, there wasn't like a classic allergy symptom. She would temper tantrum. And it turns out that her temper tantrums were a sign that her immune system was reacting to the food she was eating. So, you know, there's all kinds of signs, hundreds. On the Epidemic Answers website, we actually have a very long checklist, and you can go onto the website and look to see if some of the symptoms or signs that your kids are demonstrating might be a red flag that you should pay attention to.
Okay. Oh, can you tell us more about Epidemic Answers for those who don't know about it?
Mm-hmm. Epidemic Answers, like you mentioned, was started in 2009. And it is meant to be a repository of information and solutions for parents whose kids are affected. And that doesn't mean that you have to have a child with autism or a child with food allergies to benefit from the website and what we do. But we're trying to aggregate solutions for parents. We are trying to educate them about this environmental epidemic. And we are trying to help parents find healing solutions. So if that means connecting you to a healthcare provider, we're going to try and do that. If that means giving you information about how to change your diet, we have lots of information, for instance, on the website about how to go about trying different kinds of healing diets that help your child recover. So our main purpose is to educate, raise awareness, and then to help parents find healing solutions. One of the ways that we're doing that right now is we are in the process of raising money for a documentary film. It's entitled Canary Kids, and the film is meant to provide an expose on these environmental factors that are making our kids so sick. But more importantly, what we're aiming to do is take between 7 to 10 kids who have various diagnoses. It could be autism, it could be food allergies, it could be chronic Lyme, and we are going to provide them with free healing and recovery services. In other words, we have integrative physicians, holistic health coaches, integrative dietitians, I mean a whole team of healing professionals who have given their time pro bono. They've agreed to take these kids on for free. for the purposes of this film, because they're interested in raising awareness too. So we're going to try and heal and recover these kids and then document their recovery journey over the course of 18 months. And so we're working with an awesome director. Her name is Mary Mazzio. She just recently had a movie out called The Apple Pushers, which is amazing. You can actually get a copy of it in Whole Foods. In any case, we are raising money for this. We'll be taking in applications for families who want to help, who want to be a part of this film once we're fully funded. And so if anyone's interested in supporting that film, you can go on to epidemicanswers.org and learn a little bit more about it. It's right on the front page. It says Epidemic Answers is making a movie. So click on that and you can learn a little bit more about it.
That's pretty exciting. I think it's huge.
Very exciting. It's very exciting. So we just need to get it funded, and then we can roll, and we can help. You know, it wouldn't be so exciting to recover 10 kids for this project.
Right.
It would be great.
And it's just, it's about raising the level of awareness of people, because they just, you know, for one, they're overwhelmed by everything, and for two, they just don't know how to put everything together. And for three, a lot of people just don't even know that kids can be recovered.
Right,
if you get
exactly.
A lot of doctors these days, they don't know. They just, you know, they think autism is a psychological disorder, or the same with ADHD. They don't look at it as a holistic, whole body sort of thing, and there's dysfunction in all sorts of systems going on in your body, and they don't look at that. So,
exactly. We're trying to push
the
envelope with this film, for sure, and raising awareness is a top priority. And I think it'll do it. I think it's going to be great, and I have a lot of confidence in Mary Mazzio. Again, she's the director, to really bring this thing into the forefront of people's attention. So, yeah,
awesome.
Just got to get it funded.
All right, so you talked about Epidemic Answers, and you talked about the Environmental Working Group. Are there any other resources that you would recommend to other parents?
Healthy Child, Healthy World is another good resource in terms of, you know, learning about toxicity in the environment. There are tons of green organizations out there. Environmental Working Group is by far my favorite, because they run this database called Skin Deep, which you know about, Maria. It's an awesome mm-hmm. way that you can just go on and just check to see if the products in your home are toxic or not. There's a lot of great organizations out there that are green, and there's so many products you can buy now that are safer for your kids. And I mean, that's the one thing we have going for us now, is that we have access to, you know, foods that are you know, allergy free, and we have access to products that are safe for our children, because, you know, the world is greening a little bit. So, you know, at least we have that going for us. But, you know, Epidemic Answers is also a great repository for information as well. So, and we have a lot of links to these organizations on our website. So if you surf around our website, you'll see a lot of, it'll help you, it'll point you into the right places that you,
right.
if you need more information.
Right. And as far as the Environmental Working Group goes, too, they also just came out with a cleaners database. I don't know if you've seen that.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of shocked myself, because I thought I was using, like, the green, safe, clean kind of versions of things, and it turned out they were just as bad as everything else. So you
right.
think if it's seventh generation, it should be fine. It's not. It comes down to, like, the individual product within that company. So, you
exactly.
know, some of their products are good. Some of them really aren't. So you really have to do your homework, unfortunately, and that can be really overwhelming to a lot of people, I know.
Exactly.
All right. So is there anything else that you'd like to say about your project or Epidemic Answers? Or
The only other thing I'll say is that if you are interested in the documentary film, for either to support it, you can go on to our website. It's epidemicanswers.org/donate, and you can also go on, just make sure you get on our email, sign up on our front page of our homepage on our website. There is a, you can sign up to keep updated. We'll take your email, and then we send out updates on what's going on with the film project. So if you're interested in even, you know, potentially enrolling your child, that is, it's important to get on our email list so you can stay updated on that. And the other thing I also mentioned is that Epidemic Answers does put out newsletters occasionally that provide lots of information on particular topics. We've done one on ADHD and one on autism. Our next one coming out in a couple weeks is going to be on allergies. So make sure you put your email into the Epidemic Answers on that sign-up sheet, and then you'll be sure to get all kinds of updates on newsletters and what's going on with the film.
Facebook, the Facebook page, and then the Twitter site as well.
Of course, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and Maria is the human body behind that, all that wonderful information that comes out all the time. So that's a great way to actually, you asked about the resources. Well, the resources are circulating on the internet and Facebook. Just following us on Facebook is a great way to keep up with all of that as well. Glad you mentioned that. I forgot.
Oh, you're welcome. I try to put things on there that are like little tidbits of information that people can handle in very digestible amounts that, drinking Diet Coke, don't do it because it's got aspartame, and aspartame converts to wood alcohol, which converts to formaldehyde, which is a carcinogen. So, it's things like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's great information.
Yeah. Well, thank you. All right. So are you having any upcoming events? You were talking about the talk in Rye.
Right. I am doing a talk at the Free Library in Rye. It is November 29th, Rye, New York. It is November 29th at 7 p.m., and it's free, and I'll just be giving a talk about my book and providing a little more information about some of the healing and recovery solutions that are out there. So, it's hard to cover it all in an interview, but I'll be going into greater depth in that if anyone's interested in attending that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any fundraising events set up yet for the
We are working on a couple fundraising events. What we're trying to do, actually, is recruit people to throw small fundraisers in support of this film. So we actually have a fundraiser coming up in February in Greenwich, Connecticut, and that is a, it'll be a small fundraiser. We're going to have another one in Boston and one in New York City. And basically the way it works is somebody, in each one of these cases, somebody said, I believe in this movie. I want to help. I'm pulling my friends together and we're going to do a fundraiser. We'll have an evening out. We'll have fun and we'll raise some money to help support this film. So, put the message out there. If you know anyone that would like to support us in that capacity, we will take all the help we can get.
So let's say there's somebody like over in Phoenix, Arizona, not in the Northeast or New England. What do they do if they want to help support besides donating? Is there anything they can do?
Yes, they can. They can pull their friends together for a fundraiser, and I will fly out and help them organize it. And we actually have a fundraising director who will probably do the same. So it's the kind of thing that, people just email me all the time with ideas of things, and they're like, I've got a wacky idea, but I think I know how to help you get your film funded. And that's the way these things begin. So no idea is too wacky. Anybody can email me at any time. I'm beth@epidemicanswers.org. We're always looking for donations for the film project. We're also taking donations in kind. So, for instance, we're taking donations and corporate sponsorships, companies that have green products, green cleaning products, green personal care products, vitamins and supplements, those kinds of things we are accepting donations for the film. So you never know. If you are interested in supporting the film, there's lots of ways to do it. Best way to contact me, beth@epidemicanswers.org.
Okay. Great. Let's stop there. Unless you have anything else, do you have anything else you'd like to say, or that sounds like it's about it?
I think that's pretty good.
Okay. Let me check for questions. Okay, I've got one here from Sandy Henning, and she says, "Tell me more about the diet recommendations you make."
Okay, well, diet recommendations are best done through some kind of nutritionist or integrative dietitian or somebody who, a nutritional therapist, who is experienced in different types of healing diets. There's lots out there, but it should be tailored to a particular child and what their health issues are. For instance, there's the specific carbohydrate diet. There's the gut and psychology syndrome diet. There's the body ecology diet. There's the alkalinizing diet. There's a Weston A. Price diet. And there's lots of different ways to do this gut healing. And people have different spins on it. But again, it depends on the particular child, and so the best thing to do is to work with somebody who has some experience in all of these diets. So if you go on our website and you look up under diets, under the solutions section of our website, there is some information on diets. You can learn more about the different types of diets, but what I would do is take those diets, go into an integrative dietitian or nutritionist or nutritional therapist, and ask them what they think would be the best one for your particular child. One of the things I will say, that, though, that seems to be relatively universal in terms of healing and recovery for children is that our children are also allergic. They have so many food sensitivities. So one of the most important things that can be done is temporarily taking out foods to which they are sensitive or allergic. So that may mean doing an allergy panel, going to an allergist and finding out what they're allergic to. But there are other ways of finding out food sensitivities. There's different types of tests. For instance, an IgG test is another way. And of course, keeping a food diary and a food journal is a way to figure out a child's food sensitivities. So what I often say is that one of the most important things to do is pay attention to those food sensitivities, pull them out of the diet for a while, and then look into allergy elimination techniques. There's lots of different kinds of ways to do allergy elimination in a non-invasive way. There's Biocet, NAAT, AAT. There's all kinds of things. This is all can be found on our website. With regard to diet, I always think it's important to pay attention to food sensitivities and pull them out because they are causing in the body. So that's what I would say with regard to diets.
Okay. Let me check and see if we have any more questions. It doesn't look like we do. So if anybody's dialed in by phone and you want to ask a question, just press star 2 to raise your hand. Sometimes it takes a couple of minutes. So we'll be patient. And I'm not seeing anything. Okay. Oh, wait. We have a caller in New York. Let's see if I can figure out how to do this. Let's see. Hold on. Oh, they disappeared. Huh.
Technology.
Okay. I know. But they're back. They're back. Let me see if I know how to answer them. This is the thing. Let me put everybody in interactive mode and try that. Hi. Whoops, that's not going to work either. Hi, the person from New York City, you had a question?
Yeah, that would be me. Hi, my name is Susan, and first of all, I just want to thank both of you very much for what you're doing today and the opportunity to listen in and to really get some information. I have a 5-year-old who's been evaluated with sensory processing disorder, predominantly sensory seeking, when he was 3. And being in New York City, we had a lot of opportunity for really great services. We're now in New Jersey, not so great. But I've also had him with some of the biomedical interventions, like a lot of the blood work done and some of the other testing. And what they decided to deal with first, predominantly yeast overgrowth, very high. And we went through the first level of Diflucan, which he actually had, I think, an allergic reaction to, and then they put him on nystatin. But he's off of that now, and I think we're actually struggling with it again. And there have been other factors that I know we need to address also, like the MTH, FR gene, oxidative stress, copper zinc imbalance, low iron. I think he had high strep antibodies, parasites, low fat absorber. I mean, you know, when you do those tests, you get just a litany.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, we were taking him to a doctor up in Massachusetts, which just became undoable. And so there's two questions. One is that the next step that I'm thinking of doing with him is the GAPS diet. And I'm kind of struggling between GAPS and dealing with the yeast overgrowth. I don't know if there's any insight there. And then the other question I had was, I was glad to hear that you have on your link where to find practitioners, because we're really looking for a practitioner, I guess, locally to help us.
Yeah. So you're in New York City, right, Susan?
Yeah. Well, I work in New York City. We actually live in Maplewood, New Jersey.
Oh, New Jersey.
I'm in, yeah. So I'm in both places.
Well, I actually take a look on the website. I can't remember what we have up there for New Jersey practitioners. And like I said, we haven't fully loaded the database up. So in terms of practitioners, one of the best things you could do right now is shoot me an email. Again, it's beth@epidemicanswers.org. And I have the database that's not loaded onto the website right now, and I could certainly send you a practitioner that is nearby there, near where you are in Maplewood. I actually used to live
Great.
Near there.
Yeah.
And the other thing, your question about gaps and yeast overgrowth, I think gaps can be effective, but not as a sole approach to managing yeast. And Maria, you probably want to weigh in on this as well. And that usually, there are lots of ways to go about doing this. And again, I'm not a practitioner, so I don't
know,
give advice out that way. But I think that usually you need to have some kind of antimicrobial on board. Doing a diet like GAPS is great because GAPS actually is very healing to the whole body and, the bone broths and all those kinds of micronutrients that are part of it are really important part of that because if you have a yeast overgrowth, you're going to have all kinds of nutrient depletion, adrenal issues. And Maria, you can speak to this a little bit more, but what are your feelings about GAPS with regard to yeast overgrowth?
I think it's pretty effective, actually, but you need to do it, usually for about 2 years, which is pretty hard for a lot of people to do. That's a long road to hoe.
It can be. Body Ecology Diet is also very helpful for yeast overgrowth. But Body Ecology Diet, again, like I always say, work with somebody who is trained in this because – like the Body Ecology Diet is not great for kids on its own. It was developed by a woman, I think, in her 50s, and it's lacking things that kids need, so it has to be modified. You know what I mean?
It
was designed to overcome yeast. I mean, that was one of the main purposes of it. And so I think doing modified versions of all these diets that are tailored to your particular issues are the way to go. But again, a practitioner that is experienced in these diets can help you tailor it.
Great. And I think I'm correct in assuming that I know you, Maria, did both your children were struggling with sensory issues. Is that correct?
Yes. And they've
overcome. And then Beth, was yours also?
Mm-hmm. My oldest was sensory averter. Yeah, she had tactile sensory issues and was sensory averting, but also pressure seeking. So she had like a weird... combination of sensory issues going on, but yes, absolutely. And everybody's sensory issues are different. I found with my own experience, as soon as I took all of the major food allergens or food sensitivities out of her diet, and we took out 26, the sensory stuff evaporated overnight.
Wow. We did do gluten-free, casein-free, and that seemed to make a big improvement. But I suspect there is probably more.
I think investigating the symptoms.
Yeah, go ahead.
But not the causes. That's the thing of it, because we did it ourselves for 2.5 years, and it's great for overcoming the symptoms, but you're still not addressing the root gut dysbiosis problem because you're still feeding it with all those starches and grains.
Right. So it's a way to actually reduce the inflammatory burden on the body, and the body can start doing a little bit more repair and recovery that way. Absolutely right that you have to get to do the underlying work on the body, but it does help you eliminate the symptoms if you can find all the food sensitivities and take them out temporarily, and then you can do allergy elimination to get the food back in.
Right. So I guess my next question is then, I'm assuming that you both have seen either recovery, full recovery or partial recovery. With your
kids?
True.
Oh, yeah, totally. My kids are fully recovered. And I've talked to dozens and dozens of families who've recovered their kids from everything. I mean, severe autism, like headbanging, echolalia, or nonverbal, severely affected kids who've recovered to, kids who've reversed their allergies. I mean, I know and this is unheard of, and you don't hear about this very often, but I know families that have reversed anaphylactic allergies, which you really don't hear very often.
Wow.
But it's finding the right practitioners, and quite honestly, I think it really sometimes is going outside the box and finding people who do unique healing approaches and having an open mind and, be willing to work with people who do different kinds of approaches, holistic or integrative approaches.
Right, right. I'm actually went to the Institute of Integrated Nutrition also, which is
okay.
And that's part of my practice. So I'm in the I'm in the health field also. So I'm totally open to whoever and whatever, and I'm also not afraid just to with the input of somebody who's more knowledgeable, obviously in this area, just take it on and go ahead and do it.
Yeah, well, you're perfectly poised to do it, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about perfectly poised. I'm a vegetarian, so cooking meat is not real thrilling to me.
So those bone broths are not too appealing.
Yeah,
to your heart.
But I'll do it. It's okay. I'm okay with it.
Yeah, that's tough. Yeah, I will say, being in this area, you probably have more access to just a whole bigger number of practitioners that are well-versed in this sort of thing. I know where we are in Connecticut, there seems to be a nice little pocket of people that know how to do this, which is great. I'm guessing that's what you went through too, Beth, when you lived in
this place. Yeah. I think New York Metro has a lot of practitioners that are oriented this way. So that's one of the benefits of living sort of. And there's a ton in California as well. So New Jersey, there'll be people for you as well, Susan. But and there's some areas where it's harder to get to practitioners. But the good thing is a lot of practitioners are willing to work remotely, so you can sort of find them if they're not near you. And then there's certain things you can do remotely. Take one, mm-hmm. you'd have one visit, and then you can keep working over the phone, which is nice too.
Right. I mean, that was the biggest problem for us with the practitioner we were using. They were really big, and it was very hard to kind of sustain a relationship and keep the momentum going and keep the healing process going because the access just wasn't there. So
yeah.
I really need to come smaller, closer to home, and, consistency.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you pick a plan and you stick to it. And, as far as, diets and things, it's hard to do, but, it's worthwhile in the end, especially if you're your son, did you say? Is little or young, because it's like diet changes, for instance, are so much easier when they're little. And if you wait till they're, 16 to make a diet change, it's going to be 100 times harder. So there's no better day than today.
Well,
that's why
especially
I kind of wanted. Sorry.
Well, when they're young, their brains are still wiring and developing, so you want to get it before it goes through that pruning process that hits when they're, 6, 7, 8 years old or so.
Right.
And so if you can get him when he's 5, that's perfect.
Yeah, well, that's kind of my hope, because also trying to deal with it in a public school system, even in a private school system, is a nightmare, or from what I could see. I mean, we were in, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening.
And, and I look forward to, the future work with the film and everything else. It sounds amazing and much needed.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
All right, have a great afternoon.
You too.
All right, thank you. All right, Beth, I think that's it for all the callers. I don't think we have any more questions, so that's right at an hour. So
perfect.
We covered it very well.
Good, good.
And, so for those who, you wouldn't hear this until you listen to the replay, but I'll be sending out the replay later after this finishes getting recording. And thank you for coming on here and sharing your information with us. And we look forward to the film.
It's my pleasure, Maria. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Okay. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
The moderator.